Welcome to our second segment of this afternoon's program. It's Sunday, the 19th of December, 2021. It is now 1:43 in the studio. I'm your host, Kieran Murdoch. The aim of this next discussion is at least twofold. Firstly, we aim to discuss whether MP Michael Brown ought to be reappointed to the cabinet, as the Prime Minister Gaston Brown has announced that he intends to do. We will also discuss whether Brown should continue in electoral politics or what the fallout of his continuance in electoral politics would be. We will, of course, assess his political chances. We do have an election that everyone knows will occur at some point soon. And we'll talk about the political implications for his party and for himself of his continued candidacy. Just to inform the public, MP Michael Brown was arrested and charged with a serious offence back in November of 2020. His trial was just recently, between November and December of this year. He was found not guilty on the charge. And in the end, the scales of justice tilted in his favor. He's the Member of Parliament for All Saints West. He's a former Minister of Education, but when he was arrested in November 2020, he was relieved of that post. But the judge in the case did say that the Crown did not prove beyond all reasonable doubt that the MP was guilty of the charge, therefore he was found not guilty. The MP, of course, has maintained since the start that he is completely innocent of the allegations that were made against him. So on this segment, our main question is what ought to become of Michael Brown's political future? Or what ought to be his political future, rather? Joining our panel for this discussion, we're happy to have with us Dr. Isaac Newton. Dr. Isaac J. Newton is a political analyst, campaign manager, and public policy advisor. He's currently president of the firm Paramount Communications. And in Antigua and Barbuda, he has advised both ABLP and UPP governments. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Isaac Newton. How are you doing?
I could hear you loud and clear. Such a pleasure to be with you and your audience.
Lovely. Happy to have you. Mr. Peter Wickham joins us. He's director of the polling and research firm Caribbean Development Research Services. That's CADRES. He's done, of course, numerous electoral polls in Antigua and Barbuda and across the Caribbean. He's a commentator on Caribbean political and social affairs. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Peter Wickham. How are you doing?
Hey, good afternoon. Good to be with you again.
Mr. Akash Maharaj joins us as well. He is an ambassador at large for the Global Organization of Parliamentarians Against Corruption, known as GOPAC. Of course, that is an international non-governmental organization made up of parliamentarians from across the world working to combat corruption, strengthen good governance, and uphold the rule of law. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Maharaj. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation to join you.
Mr. Peter Wickham, I wonder if I could open the batting with you. The PM made it known that he plans to reappoint Michael Brown to his cabinet. Do you think that is a politically wise move? He was charged, he was tried, he was found not guilty. What's your view on the matter?
Well, good afternoon. And I think the Prime Minister has a choice in this matter. The charge is not one of corruption. The charge was a criminal charge. I'm not sure how much we're supposed to say about it, but in the final analysis, I've been making the point that charges of this nature are extremely difficult to prove in the scheme of things. And, you know, we're always told in law that, you know, those charges are some of the easiest to allege and hardest to prove, especially when the individuals are known to each other. And therein lies the problem. So I think under the circumstances, the sure thing to do was to give him the opportunity to prove his innocence. He's done that. And I think against that background, the Prime Minister has little choice. I also think that what has happened now is that essentially the minister has been morally strengthened. The Member of Parliament has been morally strengthened, Mike Brown, because he has defended himself in a court of law. He's been found innocent by a jury of his peers. And as a result, he continues on. And if he is interested in continuing in politics, it will be difficult to see how this does not strengthen his resolve, because it does appear as though he was unfairly targeted and victimized. And he now has to make good on that politically.
And just to clarify, statute prevents us from discussing the nature of the charge, so we will not discuss the nature of the charge, and we'll try to avoid getting into any other details that could lead to, you know, the identification of the nature of the charge. Mr. Maharaj, at this point, Michael Brown enjoys the status of having been found not guilty. Is there any reason that you think he should be prevented from being reappointed to the cabinet?
On the face of it, no. This is an especially... There's a simple way to approach this and a more complex way to approach it. The simple way is that he has been tried in a court, he's been found not guilty, and in a democracy, either we believe in the presumption of innocence or we don't. As a result, being found not guilty should be tantamount to living a life as if the accusation had never been made. The complication in this, of course, is that he is not just an ordinary citizen, he is a politician, and often there are cases, or not infrequently there are cases, where facts come out during a trial that don't suggest that person should be convicted, but change the way the public view that person. Because of the nature of this trial, where all the details are confidential, the public has no access to that information. All the information they have access to is to know that he was charged with a crime and he was found not guilty. And on the basis of that, I can't see how the Prime Minister could properly do otherwise, other than to restore him to the position he was in prior to the charges.
And Dr. Isaac Newton, it's always problematic when a public official is suspected of or charged with a crime. And as a person, they're entitled to the presumption of innocence until guilt is proven. In the case of Michael Brown, a court could not find him guilty, found him not guilty. But there are many who will still lack confidence in that verdict. Will his returning to the cabinet stain the office which he may hold in the future, do you think? What's your view?
I do not see any conflict of interest between his return to the cabinet and him being found not guilty. Now, courts cannot rule on whether another person is innocent. They have to examine facts and evidence to determine whether or not persons are found guilty. And it's unique because even if one believes a person is guilty, if the evidence or the facts in the court does not amount to the criteria of beyond a shadow of a doubt, you know, the legally one ought to, the scales of justice will tip in the direction of that individual. Listen, I think this is a settled issue unless, of course, additional facts were to be brought to the table and evidence, and the state has an interest in taking the case further. He is found not guilty. He has answered to the charges. And one has to believe, as my colleague suggested early on, that you know, that there was the judge did look at the evidence and weighed fairly against the law and ruled. If it is that he is found guilty, and he has been found not guilty, I mean, then the Prime Minister rationale for removing him from office was, listen, man, you have to answer to these charges. You have answered to them. And, you know, as a follow through on his own word of integrity, there is absolutely no reason why he can't be sent back to represent his people.
Mr. Peter Wickham, I want to get a little bit of insight from you really quickly into the procedure that you think we should take when we have these sorts of incidents. In this case, we would have seen the Prime Minister would have relieved Michael Brown of his position. In fact, I'm not sure. Sometimes it differs between who says who was sacked and who says who resigned. I saw that in the issue of Asset Michael as well. He was removed from the cabinet. Some at the time might have thought that it would have been well for him to resign as an MP as well. I'm just curious what you think the procedure should be when we have elected officials and we have serious allegations, even police charges brought against them. And of course, there has to be a process before we get to determination of guilt or not guilty. But, you know, in the meantime, they're charged. How should they step aside from public life? To what extent?
No, it's difficult, and I think the reality is that you're facing something that has not really happened that frequently in the Caribbean. I don't know of another similar case in this regard. You know, when a person is found or is charged or is alleged of some impropriety as it relates to the use of public office, which was the case with the allegations against Asset Michael, it's easy to say, okay, the party should take a hands-off position and say, you know, we won't allow this gentleman to serve as a minister. Ultimately, he's elected by the people, so the people have to make the determination of whether to elect him or not. So the Prime Minister shouldn't require him. Well, he can anyhow. He can't force him to resign his seat. And I think the case with a criminal matter is somewhat similar in that regard, where the least a Prime Minister could do is say that someone with a criminal charge pending cannot serve in his cabinet. The only person that can require of him a resignation from the House is the persons that have elected him, which is the individuals. And the constituents don't really have an opportunity to recall or anything like that, so they have to wait on the judgment of the court, which has now come. So I think that the proper procedure was followed in that the PM said once, you know, he is having a charge of his pending, you know, then hands off, you're on your own, you prove your innocence, and then you come back. I think the challenge may very well come where there might have been people that felt that one could almost allege anything against a minister, and where is the bar set? So, for example, if someone is charged with criminal libel, should that person also be required to be removed from the cabinet? In the same way that Kadasa can be a criminal matter. Now, my sense is that the Prime Minister has to make a judgment where he sets the bar in terms of what you can and cannot get away with in terms of a charge while serving in his cabinet. So a traffic offense, similarly, you know, a minor traffic offense is considered criminal in some instances. I don't see where that should prevent someone from serving in the cabinet. If, however, a member of parliament is drunk and knocks down someone, then certainly that should be something which is a criminal charge that would make it difficult to serve in a cabinet. So I think the Prime Minister has exercised judgment. I think under the circumstances he did. I don't see a basis for saying he needs to resign from parliament simply because he is elected by the people and the people have to make a determination as to when, you know, that election needs to be held over. And ultimately they will have that chance in the not too distant future to determine his bona fides going forward. But, you know, the big thing for me is the careful, we have to be careful that we don't make it such that any allegation or any criminal allegation against a member of parliament or a minister is enough to remove that individual, because I think that it would be unfair if we went on that route.
Well, that's an interesting point there. Mr. Mahaj, what do you think about that? Because in the nature of the politics that unfortunately plays out in the Caribbean, it plays out in many other places similarly, but in the nature of the politics that plays out in the Caribbean, sometimes people are subject to smear. Now, I'm not debating as to whether or not that was the case in this instance. I'm just saying that in the nature of our politics, you do have smear. You do have sometimes persons caught up in a false allegation. And so there's this fear that if on the mere basis of an allegation, you know, you're out of there, well, you know, you could just remove a government, you know, just by spreading allegations. What should our paramount interest be? Do you think it should be ensuring that no one is unfairly punished for alleged wrongs which have not been satisfactorily proven to a court? And to what extent should our paramount interest be preserving the image and integrity of public office? Because sometimes you can have someone who is innocent, hasn't done something, or has been found not guilty of something, and yet still there is an image and perception of them which is quite harmful, and for them to be in public office might be an issue. But what do you think?
I don't think it is at all rare for politicians to either hurl false accusations at one another or to have false accusations hurled at them. Clearly, merely being accused by someone should not be enough to require someone to step aside, especially in politics, because unfortunately, baseless allegations have become the norm in democracies around the world. The question is always, how serious is the allegation? If it's an allegation made by a political opponent, that is on one end of the spectrum, where it is perhaps unsubstantiated, certainly unproved, and made by someone with an interest in seeing the other person hurt. On the other extreme is this case, where we had a sitting politician who was not just charged by the police, but brought before a court, and the court, in the first instance, thought that there was enough evidence to require a full criminal trial. I think it was correct, therefore, that he stood down and that he awaited the verdict of the court before deciding what happens next. The broader question, though, of whether someone who's been accused of a serious crime and then exonerated in the court or found not guilty in the court should continue to have a political career depends on a wide variety of factors. And unfortunately, it's difficult to come up with a single hard and fast rule. But one of the critical considerations is whether the population has confidence in the judicial system to deliver justice. Do they believe that a not guilty verdict is correct under the law and under justice, and or do they believe that that there's a chance that the verdict has been politically manipulated? Antigua is a very unusual country, because according to most international studies. Antiguans have one of the highest levels of trust in their judicial system of all the nations of the Caribbean, but they also have one of the lowest levels of trust of the police of all nations in the Caribbean. It is very unusual to find a country where the population thinks highly of its judges and very poorly of its police force. But given that this matter has been decided by a court, I suspect that on balance, the majority of Antiguans, given their general confidence in the judiciary and its independence and its ability to deliver justice, for them that will be sufficient. I guess I will add as one final matter. In terms of political accusations that we see in Antigua and Barbuda, it is again a curious situation. Right now we have, you've mentioned Asset Michael and the Prime Minister Gaston Browne. They regularly trade with one another accusations of the most abject corruption in the House of Parliament. Those accusations typically cannot be introduced into a court because of parliamentary privilege. But at least according to Gaston Browne himself, some of the accusations he's making against Asset Michael suggest that he, the Prime Minister, knew that Asset Michael was committing acts of corruption, but chose to protect him. It is unfortunate that Antigua and Barbuda has a Prime Minister who's prepared to stand up in public and say that he protected a demonstrably corrupt colleague, someone he says is demonstrably corrupt. It would be still more perverse if he were now to punish someone who had been exonerated by the court. It would mean that Antigua and Barbuda has a government that protects the guilty and punishes the innocent.
Yeah, the allegedly guilty. Dr. Isaac Newton, if I could ask you a more political question as to whether or not you think people in general, in terms of that question of confidence in the court system and confidence in the verdict, I mean, it does vary from time to time with the status of an individual in society. When someone is a politician, sometimes we can have a general level of heightened mistrust towards that individual. You know, persons may believe that, you know, they get away with this or they get away with that. So I'm just curious as to what you think in terms of the politics and the optics of this from the average man's point of view. You know, will he be satisfied that, look, this matter came, there was an allegation, it was tried, it was charged, you know, that was enough of a demonstration that the system is working. A court was not able to determine that this person was guilty. They found him not guilty. They said, you know, we're not satisfied what's here that we can convict on this charge. And that's the end of it. What do you think? Will people mostly take that?
I really do think so, you know. In the Caribbean, generally speaking, the landscape is that people are skeptical of the judiciary system. And that is primarily one of the reasons why most Caribbean countries have not endorsed the CCJ as the final court of appeal, because there's a sense in which power and politics can influence the judiciary in one way or the other. And then at the high court level, it seemed to me that people seem to have a high level of trust, as my colleague indicated earlier on, in terms of judges being able to weigh evidence, look at the facts, and against law and sound judgment, make a ruling. We all accept the fact that the courts cannot determine whether another person is innocent. Innocent meaning that the crime has never occurred, but rather that whether or not the facts before the court and the evidence is compelling enough such that the criteria of beyond a shadow of a doubt is breached or not breached. And in this case, I really believe that in most people's mind, politically, the matter is settled. I don't think that individuals believe that the good judge was anyway influenced politically. I think persons got the impression that the high profile nature of the case would have placed the court on the red alert, and that in fact the court being perceived as the last bastion in a democracy to shut down prosecutorial overreach and to correct sloppy police and investigative job. would then be able to examine these facts before it and make a judgment. In Michael's case, I think that the charges were very serious. And I believe that most people believe, as especially the feedback I've heard from the diaspora and from people on the ground, regardless of their political persuasion, that in fact, there is some sense of confidence that justice is served. And if people really believe that, and we shall see when they go to the polls pretty soon, I believe that there's absolutely no barrier to Mr. Michael being considered for public office. And if he were to have kept closely with his constituents and continue to do the work, he most likely will be reelected by that constituency.
Mr. Peter Wickham, do you think that this incident could become an issue, this trial? Could be, despite the not guilty verdict, could become a political issue. Any opposition party worth its salt, might suggest to its supporters that that they ought to lack confidence in when you have persons on the other side who have actually faced criminal trial, especially in an instance where the public is sort of at a loss because they cannot know the details because of the nature of the charges. They cannot know the details. So it's not even to say that the person could point to the details, the nitty gritty, and say, okay, well, look, clearly you can see here where the court made this determination on these facts. Those things have to remain confidential because of the nature of the charges. So do you think it'll become an issue politically on the campaign trail?
Two things. I don't think that the public is in any at a loss regarding the details of the matter. I mean, I think that we have to do, we have to walk a tightrope in terms of public commentary. But I think the reality is that you would search hard in Antigua to find somebody who does not understand the nature and the details of this case.
Well, I've actually phoned Antiguans. Generally, there are a lot of people who, what is reported in the news is what is reported. Well, yeah, I do know the details, but I have the benefit of working at Observer.
So Antigua is a small place, so word gets around. I'm pretty convinced that people know the details of the case, and I think that it is the type of matter that would lead people to believe that maybe there is something more that we don't know. I would be very surprised if people are judging him on that. Certainly, people would speak about it in undertones, in their own houses, and they would have conversations among themselves. But I don't sense that it is a matter that can become a political issue on the platform. Maybe somebody can leak a voice note and circulate it to attack the man's credibility. But in terms of public pronouncements, I would be very, very surprised if anyone in the opposition attempts to make an issue of it simply because it's a type of delicate matter. I think that people will have the undertones and they will speak among themselves and so on. But, I do feel that Antiguans, well, people in the Caribbean, generally speaking, and I got in trouble for this week, but I'm going to say again, they have
You didn't get into legal trouble, did you?
Not legal trouble.
Okay, just making sure.
Because I said that they had a high tolerance for political corruption. And it's not
that's true.
A set suggesting that Antiguans are any different to Barbados.
That's extremely true.
That we in the Caribbean tolerated a bit more. This is not political corruption. And I think that the nature of the issue is such that we are likely to understand a bit better the peculiar circumstances that would have led him into this situation. And I think excuse it under the circumstances. So my confidence is that the average Antiguan knows what this is about, and the average Antiguan is not going to judge the individual harshly in a situation like this, especially as he's been exonerated in that matter. There was another similar matter in one of the other islands, the matter was not prosecuted in the way that people felt it should have. In other words, the person never went before the court. Had that happened and he'd been exonerated, it would have been different. And I think that the concerns that the opposition raised in this instance is that the Director of Public Prosecutions did not even take the matter to court. And I think you know where I'm speaking about. The case was St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Mm-hmm. And the treatment was different. The individual was considerably more powerful, but the details, the salacious details, are in the public domain. And I think that we can talk about that one. But the difference was that, he was in tried and exonerated by a jury of his peers. And I think that really is what makes a difference here.
Well, actually, it's interesting. You use the term exonerated. I would refer to Dr. Isaac Newton, who has talked about how the court does not find one innocent, you might be able to extrapolate that if you actually have the details. You know, the details point to you that, you know, something is trumped up. You may be able to say, okay, well, that's trumped up. In this case, we don't have the details. But the court is basically making a determination as to whether the evidence before it right now in this moment is enough to substantiate a guilty verdict on these charges. And in this case, it was not satisfied and the verdict was not guilty. You mentioned something that I wanted to bring in, and it has slipped my mind. Something in the last thing.
Getting old.
Oh gosh. In any event,
was it in relation to the Gonzales matter?
No. Not at all. It was. Anyway, it'll come back to me. In the meantime, let me go to Mr. Akash Maharaj. Mr. Maharaj, do you share that view as to, you know, what the public view on the issue might be, that, you know, accept the verdict, be suspicious of the verdict? And of course, for instance, we had a discussion on this station about the UPP bus saga and the not guilty verdict that was rendered in that case. But interestingly, in the midst of the discussion, because of course in that instance we were able to examine the nitty-gritty of the case, the charges didn't prohibit us from getting into it. We were able to see that despite the not guilty verdict, that, you know, some could come to the conclusion that at different points there was behavior that some might consider unethical on the part of different individuals. Individuals who weren't even charged, but anyway. And in addition to that, it was actually revealed that in that instance, the prosecution apparently brought forward an extremely sloppy case that a lot of people thought was doomed to failure. But Mr. Maharaj, your take on, you know, how the public might receive this incident, it having been dispatched as not guilty.
Normally, I would say that I would expect the public in Antigua and Barbuda to accept the verdict and the judgment of the court and to move on. The UPP bus scandal, though, that bus case, does potentially throw a different light on matter, not because of the verdict or what was revealed during that case, but because of the response of political actors, the Prime Minister and members of the governing party, to the verdict. After the judge brought down a not guilty verdict in the UPP case, or a no case to answer verdict, which in some ways is still stronger, many political actors on the governing side, on the government party, made public statements to the effect that they felt that this was an inappropriate judgment. And I believe the matter is under appeal. That is instructive for why politicians should not weigh in on cases that are before the court, because having offered an opinion, having attempted to marshal public opinion against a judicial decision in favor of the opposition politicians, they open the door to opposition politicians trying to marshal public opinion against a government MP when he has been exonerated. Politics and justice do not mix well. And the declarations of political actors and the verdicts of independent judges don't mix well at all. I'd hope that the public in Antigua and Barbuda have enough confidence in the judicial system to accept the decision of a judge and to move on. But if they do not, I would say it is the political class itself in Antigua and Barbuda that has only itself to blame.
Dr. Isaac Newton, any comments you want to make at this point, particularly as go ahead.
Yeah, two things. One, I believe that judges can get it wrong. And so therefore, I believe that there must be the public opinion matters, and the individuals within the public square must be able to judge the judges. The judges' decisions are not beyond the pale of imperfection. Sometimes judges get it wrong. Sometimes courts get it wrong. And sometimes it's not malicious. Sometimes the evidence before them, and sometimes new evidence change the dynamics. We have seen that in the United States, for example, recently, where a young man, having spent 43 years in prison, you know, it was the wrong ruling. Of course, there's the racial reality here that's just unfortunate. But I do believe, that, like my colleague, that, you know, politicians must be careful. But I also believe that they have a right to be able to say whether or not they believe a ruling was just and justifiable. What I think ought to happen, though, is that those who operate the levers of justice, whether it's the DPP or the judges or those who are involved in detective work, etc., must so be committed passionately to their oath of office that they ought not to allow the political declarations to negatively influence them. I'm not saying that within a social context that doesn't occur. I'm just simply saying that we ought to elect men and women of integrity who are then able to say, I don't care, I don't give two kicks on the fingernail about what the politicians say. I'm going to do my job faithfully according to my oath and with the level of balance, integrity, objectivity, and lawfulness that is within the paradigm of my office. I must say that I don't usually agree with our political analyst here from Barbados, but today he's shooting on every single cylinder that is perfect, and I agree with his take and his analysis, in a very healthy way.
Coming back to you, Mr. Wickham. Now I remember what I wanted to ask. I will. I think it was a question to Mr. Maharaj, but I'll ask it after this. But on the issue of the politics of this, going into the next election in All Saints West, what do you think is the political situation there, given this issue, given how it has played out, given the result we've seen of it now? What sort of effect do you think it'll have on the Labour Party in that constituency?
Yeah, I mean, that presents an interesting concern, and I want to thank Dr. Newton for his, as I said, usually we are sparring on these issues, so it's good that I am in this corner. It's comforting. Yeah, the situation at All Saints West is it's a slightly different matter, and, you know, Dr. Brown was, some would argue he's been skating on thin ice for a while in terms of his role as a representative. He's not necessarily one of the strongest ministers, or was not necessarily one of the strongest ministers going in. And during the course of this time, he has lost ground. Presumably, he couldn't campaign, he couldn't be in the field, and he couldn't have been active because to show his face, you know, creates questions. And I think that he has lost considerable time. The question is whether or not the opposition has made good use of this time. So I think there's a balance in that. And certainly, you know, morally, he could have gained some ground for having faced this matter down and proceeded. But if you assume that this is now null and void, he goes back to the situation before. He was always going to be a person that he's not an asset maker in terms of his ability to win a seat very easily. He's always a person that has to put in some hard work in order to be able to retain that seat. And I'm curious to know whether, having lost several months in this process, whether he can just jump back in the saddle and hope to ride home successfully, or whether or not the UPP would have made good on the opportunities that were presented to it in the time that he was off the scene to have their own candidates out there and battling to try and gain public support. So that part is an interesting question.
Mr. Maharaj, the question earlier that I had slipped my mind was, I thought it was interesting, this was one of the judge alone trials. There was a significant debate when, because of COVID-19, the issue of having judge alone trials came up. A lot of people thought, some were for, some were against, as to whether or not, you know, the right to a trial by jury, you know, how would a jury find on a case as opposed to a judge, the technical issues of fair justice. Do you think that will have any impact on how persons perceive this case, Mr. Maharaj, the fact that it was a judge-only trial?
I suspect not, simply because while one can debate the efficacy and the biases in judge-only trials and jury trials, the choice to have a judge-only trial was not up to either the defendant, either the accused or the accuser. That being the case, I don't think anyone is going to assign any meaning to that fact, to the actual outcome. It varies from country to country, even within common law systems. There's some countries where all serious trials are done in front of a jury. There's some countries where no serious trial is done in front of a jury, and some countries where the accused has the option to opt for one or the other. It depends, interestingly enough, on whether the population feels that it has confidence in its judges or more confidence in its fellow citizens. from a, I mean, stepping back from it, what will the population make of all of this? I think it is important to also consider the impact, and I won't just say on Mr. Brown in this case, just generally speaking, the impact of being charged on people who are later exonerated. It's an awful thing for someone who has not committed a crime to have to go through the judicial process. And the taint of that remains with that person often for their entire lives, both the personal trauma and the nagging suspicion that perhaps he really was guilty. And those suspicions will almost always be inflamed in the public mind when the person who has been accused is a political actor and therefore necessarily is viewed through a partisan lens. I come from Canada. I live in Canada. In Canada, about 40% of people who are charged with crimes in this country are exonerated in some form or the other. Either they are formally acquitted or the Crown prosecutor decides that there's no case to answer and drops the charges, or the charges are stayed. But in a developed democracy, the idea that nearly half the people who are charged with crimes are ultimately found to be not guilty, and most of those people, the case is so weak that it never proceeds to trial at all, is pretty astounding. It suggests that you are almost as likely to be innocent as guilty if you are charged with a crime. But nevertheless, 100% of the people who have been charged will walk away with some scars from that experience. I think that in most democracies, we've become increasingly aware that the reality is that to be accused is not one and the same thing as to be guilty. But we have not yet gotten away from a situation where the accusation can be the punishment. The very fact that we cannot talk about the details of this case, the very fact that there is a judicial injunction against talking about the details of the case, is evidence that the court system itself recognizes that the mere fact of the accusation and the details of the accusation can harm the accused and the accuser, that we have not yet as societies reached a level of maturity where, though we understand the words innocent or proven guilty, that we emotionally accept that. And that, I think, should trouble us. Either if we do not have confidence in our judicial systems, then we should, as societies, try to rectify those judicial systems. But it is an unfortunate thing that it has always been, and I suspect it will always be the case, that to a certain extent, to be accused is to be punished, irrespective of whether you committed the crime.
There was one question that someone did ask me to ask, and that was, we're wrapping up now, but that was whether or not it was odd or out of place for the on the MP's defense team was Sir Gerald Watt, who is the Speaker of the House. Someone asked me to ask the question if that was an odd thing. Do you think that was an odd thing, Mr. Maharaj? Would it have been better for the Speaker to, being that he was a Speaker, to avoided being placed in that sort of matter, or does it really not matter? He's an attorney. That's what he does.
I think it does matter. And I think that was a bizarre choice on his part. Once you become a lawyer, or once you become the lawyer for a client, you are bound to solicitor-client confidentiality. There are things that the Speaker will know about that member of Parliament that he is enjoined from sharing with anyone else. And it is possible, by no means certain, but it is possible that things would have come out during that process that the Speaker of the House of Commons, or the Speaker of the Legislature, should find unacceptable as sitting MP. But now he can't act on them because he only knows that through solicitor-client privilege. I don't think it is right. It is a structural conflict of interest for someone who serves as the Speaker, a kind of quasi-judicial body for the legislature, to act in private practice at the same time. What would he have done, or what would he do as Speaker, if Mr. Brown had been convicted, but then decided to chose to remain as an MP? How would he rule, or how will he rule, on matters that Mr. Brown might say in the legislature that he as a Speaker might know to be untrue, but cannot reveal that fact because he knows it through privileged information? I think that by representing an accused person in court, when he must also rule over that person in the legislature, is unsustainable.
Dr. Isaac Newton, what do you think about that question as we wrap up?
100%. I think it was most inappropriate and and a conflict of interest, and perhaps even unethical if you were to push the envelope. You want to be able to maintain some level of distance, although it was legal. Simply because something is legal don't necessarily make it ethical or even best practice. Sometimes there's some loops in the law. So I frowned at that. And that's not to pass negative judgment on the Speaker of the House capacity as a lawyer to adjudicate rightly and to represent his client, etc. But it's just to say, as my colleague just indicated, that those separate institutions require different function, and that one person must be able to carry those functions out without conflict of interest. One saw him. I saw a video of him gloating, and he was extremely happy in his pronouncement, but because he was on the legal team. I wonder what would have happened if he had lost the case. How might he have responded? So I'm 100% with my colleague there. On the issue of whether or not, back to my colleague from our brilliance, on the issue of whether or not I think this is going to affect Mr. Brown, I think that the community will excuse him, because they understood that he had to defend his name. He had to give himself some distance to address this matter. So I don't believe the impact of his unavailability will be perceived as negligent. And I think that the moral wind his wings could give him rising power. I'm sure the opposition would not have been able to gain inroad on this matter in the constituency. In fact, I think that this give Brown's an edge, and he may pull it off.
Mr. Peter Wickham, I'll give you the final word very briefly.
I think if this thing with the speaker was interesting, I actually didn't know that, and I also wasn't aware that it was the judge that made the directive, but I'm always minded that in legal matters, the judge can direct the jury to return a not guilty verdict anyhow. So even if there was a jury, the outcome could have been similar in the situation where the judge was convinced in relation to the evidence. The speaker thing was interesting. A few years ago in Barbados, the speaker of the house was actually, not convicted, but he lost, judgment was passed against him in a court where he was advised to return money to a client that was due, which was interesting. While he was speaker, that matter was done, it was handed down by High Court, and the jurisdiction was respected, and the speaker did not resign, which many of us thought he should have. But so this one is an interesting one, but it appears as though in the Caribbean there's a line drawn between the speaker's work as an MP and the speaker's work as a speaker. We have a situation currently in Barbados where a major case, a criminal matter where a law is being challenged, has been brought, a constitutional matter has been brought by the speaker as a client, as a lawyer on behalf of one of his clients, in which he's essentially suing the government for legislation that he believes is outside of the Constitution. And he's Speaker of the House. So these are some peculiar matters. And I think the one good thing is that had he been found guilty, or had the matter had gone forward and he'd been found guilty, he would not be a Member of Parliament, because he would automatically be unable to serve as a Member of Parliament beyond that. So I don't think the Speaker would be in a position where he would have to rule against him, because I think that the Speaker would acknowledge that his client would need to resign based on the rules that we have in Barbados. But thanks for the opportunity to participate in the conversation.
Of course. Just to recap our panel for this evening, folks, we've come to the end of our discussion. We were joined, of course, by the last voice you heard there was Mr. Peter Wickham, director of the polling and research firm Cadres. That's the Caribbean Development Research Services, also a political and social commentator as well. We were joined by Dr. Isaac Newton. He's currently president of the firm Paramount Communications. He is, of course, a political analyst, campaign manager, and a public policy advisor. And finally, we were joined by Mr. Akash Maharaj, ambassador at large for the Global Organization of Parliamentarians Against Corruption, known as GOPAC. Thanks to all three of you for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, Jeff.